this special U.S. Open episode of Musings on Golf. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with my good friend Bob Bupka. And Bob, we're going to be joined shortly by our great friend Mark Rolfing from NBC Sports and Golf Channel. But as we record this on Wednesday, June 7th, the world of golf is still trying to figure out all the repercussions of the major news yesterday with the merger of the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, and the Public Investment Fund, which oversees LIV Golf. It was quite a seismic day in the history of the game.
Well, it certainly was a seismic day, Kelly. And before we even get to that, and before we get to the U.S. Open, I just want to express my sentiments about Mark Rolfing. I've had the pleasure and honor of going to Hawaii for a good number of years, covering golf tournaments, both the Sony and the Tournament of Champions. And to be in the presence of Mark Rolfing, affectionately known in Hawaii as Mr. Hawaii Golf, is an honor that I don't take lightly. And then covering the 150th Open Championship, I'm walking down a quaint little street in St. Andrews, and who do I come across? None other than Mark and Debbie Rolfing. I said, golly, the golfing gods are smiling down on me to have this chance encounter come to be. Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Well, you're welcome, Bob. And I will tell you also, the 150th Open is going to go down as one of my favorite championships in my entire career. And it would not have been complete if I hadn't bumped into you on that street. I have respected you and admired you for so long. I've always been jealous. If I had your pipes, I might have gotten somewhere in this business. But I appreciate it. I appreciate the friendship. And it's just great being on with you and Kelly, with Janice at the controls. That's what I really like here.
Well, there's none better than her. All right, let's move on, and let me ask you this to get things going, Mark. What should our listeners expect to see from the North Course at LA Country Club, which is hosting the U.S. Open for the first time next week?
They're going to be surprised and shocked, not quite as much as we all were yesterday in the world of golf, with the PGA Tour and Saudi Investment Fund, but they're going to be really surprised at what they see. Of course, LA Country Club has got 36 holes. That's one of the reasons why it's a good site. So the South Course can be utilized for staging a U.S. Open. But it's a golf course that's got a lot of contrast to it. It's got fairways that are wide open. These are going to be the widest fairways we've seen probably since Erin Hills, and maybe even wider in some cases than Erin. But it's a very demanding course. I think you're going to see a much more rugged look to it than what we typically would see at a U.S. Open. This has got a gigantic barranca that goes between two ridges. Basically, what LA Country Club North is two big ridges, and going between them is a barranca. So you're kind of going up and down and through and meandering around. But there's a lot of very natural, scruffy areas where your golf ball can end up in a lot of bad places.
Based on what you say, Mark, does this course favor any particular style of player? Bomber, great putter? You know, what do you see?
Yes.
Good answer.
You know, Bob, I don't see any golf course these days where the big hitters don't have an advantage. You know, talk if you want about the smaller courses and places like that, but I still truly believe distance has become such an important factor in the game, and that will be the case. I don't think you're going to see a fluke winner of this U.S. Open. I think it'll be one of the established stars. But I think if anything, distance is going to be really important there. So, you know, just go right down the list, and the guys that I'm seeing are the Schefflers and Rahms, and I've got my eye on Xander Schauffele. He just has a complete game. The thing I think you're going to see about about LA Country Club is that where it may not favor any particular style of play, what it is going to favor is a player that doesn't have any weaknesses. If you've got a weakness, whether it's driving, approach play, chipping, bunker play, putting, if there's any weakness, it's going to get exposed at LA North over 72 holes. You will not be able to fake it around there with smoke and mirrors and kind of play with a weakness or a deficiency. It'll get exposed.
So pleased to be joined by the ambassador for golf for the great state of Hawaii and our friend from Golf Channel and NBC Sports, Mark Rolfing. Hey, Mark, peel back the onion a little bit for us and give us a sense of your responsibilities for the week in terms of the preparation that goes into it, when you fly to Los Angeles, and what you know your schedule is going to be, at least in the first few days of the week.
Well, Monday is going to be my reconnaissance day. So I will fly and arrive in LA on Sunday, and I will go straight out there Monday morning and spend the entire day. I'm not really that familiar with the venue. I was there years ago, but I really have to get myself acclimated to it pretty quickly because let's say I was going to be an on-course commentator the first day, which would be Tuesday, I would prepare differently than going on live from the U.S. Open on Tuesday. So what I will do is I will try to understand the course and study the course, but I also would like to be able to talk to as many players as I can, whether it's about the U.S. Open or LIV Golf or whatever it is, because, you know, that's kind of always been my strength, my relationship with the players. My first assignment will be live from the U.S. Open on Tuesday. I will do the daytime show both Tuesday and Wednesday. So I'm going to have to deal with not only the U.S. Open, but all the other issues that are going on in the game. So I have to get acclimated pretty quickly, and I won't be actually starting to work on any live golf until Thursday because there won't be any competitive golf till Thursday. So it's kind of a mixed bag of things that I have to do here to get ready.
So let's touch on that for a minute. Next week will be a most unusual week. And there have been a bunch of them of late with major championships. So much of the talk should be about the golf course and the championship itself. But as will be the case next week, a lot of it, but Monday through Wednesday, will be about this merger that was announced yesterday. Mark, what were your initial thoughts when you heard about it?
I was shocked. I was stunned. I had no idea it was coming. You know, I've been pretty much on the forefront for Golf Channel over the last year or so with this whole LIV thing, but this one caught me completely off guard. As I look at it and analyze it, there is so much information missing. I don't have it. I'm not sure really a whole lot of people do. It sounds like the players don't have information. Kelly, when I dissected, this is not a merger. This is not a merger. This is a creation of a new entity. A new entity is being created as a for-profit entity, of which the PGA Tour will be part of that as its own standalone 501c6, which is not for profit. But this is not LIV Golf and the PGA Tour merging. I'm not sure LIV Golf will stay intact as an organization. I'm pretty sure it won't. What this is a new entity being created, and it's basically being funded by the Saudi Public Investment Fund.
That's correct. In terms of that reference to a for-profit, that was noted in the release that went out yesterday. Rory McIlroy today, again Wednesday, in his press conference at the RBC Canadian Open, kind of, I think, sadly referred to himself as a sacrificial lamb. I'm wondering your feelings about Rory as in my opinion, such a stand-up guy and really the face of the PGA Tour for all the past year. And now the decision to essentially get in bed with those that the PGA Tour was against. It seems to me it's a sad time, and I'm wondering your thoughts, particularly about people like Rory.
I feel really bad for Rory. We haven't heard from Tiger, so I'm not sure what his mindset is, but I think I feel bad for Tiger too. Again, it was totally unexpected. What it says to me is that the PGA Tour has been on a financial path the last couple of years that was just not sustainable. In fact, Jay Monahan referred to it a year ago. He said, if this is gets into a battle about the money, the PGA Tour can't compete. And if you think about the PGA Tour the last 3 years here, Kelly and Bob, first they had to subsidize the recovery from COVID and go into their reserves to put out a lot of money just to keep events afloat. Then they had to enhance those events the next year, basically to be able to compete with LIV Golf. So they just kept going to the well time and time again to get more money. Nobody knew where it was really coming from. Nobody knew really how much was being spent other than the PGA Tour Policy Board, I'm sure, and a few of the players. And now they were staring down the pike at, you know, a situation where legally they could have been on the hook for millions and millions of dollars that they really don't have. And so in the end, I truly believe it's very simple. What happened here? The money prevailed. People changed their minds. Jay Monahan yesterday said, look, I made the decisions that I did a year ago or 2 years ago based on the information I had then. You know, circumstances have changed. He has not told us what changed. That is my number one question. What has caused this change that the PGA Tour would do a 180-degree about face and all of a sudden become effectively a partner now with the Saudi Public Investment Fund?
Well, Mark, isn't it likely, though, that what changed is exactly what you just said, and that is all the finances that the PGA Tour had to dip into and the legal possibilities of being in court for a number of years, it wasn't a sustained, it appeared not to be a very sustainable model for very long.
I don't think it was, Kelly. There could be some other factors. We don't know. There's all kinds of rumors going around. You've heard it, you know, rumors about a number one player in the world, you know, major champion that was about ready to defect and go to LIV. All those kind of things maybe could have had an influence. I'm not really sure. But in the end, the money prevailed. And that's what concerns me going forward, is that, you know, the public investment fund, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, is the sole investor right now in this partnership. And they have an exclusive right to invest more and to approve whoever else is taken in as a financial partner. The more time goes on, the bigger chunk of money they're going to have into it. Where there's money, there's control. So we may be looking at a situation right now where the PGA Tour is still in total control, but who knows what that'll look like 10 years down the road.
Hey, Mark, I heard something on the grapevine, and based on my knowledge of the situation, I could see it being true. Jay Monahan had been privy to where you live in Maui, with one of the greatest home sites that I've ever seen in person. And he said, hey, wait a minute. If I ever want to live in Maui with a home like Mark Ralphing, I got to turn this ship around a little bit.
Well, that's nice of you to say, but I can tell you this place is not for sale. You know, that's kind of a joke, because I felt like the PGA Tour wasn't for sale either. And now, you know, I'm kind of questioning what is happening here. I'm particularly concerned for us here in Hawaii, because really what, you know, is going to happen is that they're going to play out this 2023 season, and this new world order that we have, if this deal goes through, is going to start with the Century Tournament of Champions on Maui. The problem is that event is less than 7 months away. I do not think this final agreement between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour is going to get done in short order. It's going to take a long time, because they're giving up all their rights to any future litigation. And before they sign that, there's got to be a lot more decisions made. So my question then becomes, okay, it's not like the BMW Championship next year, which is played in August. They would have an extra 9 months to figure out what to do. But who's going to play in Century? Who's going to be eligible? What's the name of the tournament going to be? How are all those decisions going to be made when we're on a tiny little island out here? We've got to ship stuff on a barge from the mainland to get it here. You know, that all starts in October. We're only a couple of months from having to have made all these gigantic decisions that we can't make because we don't have the information.
All right, let's switch gears here a little bit, Mark. And I know you've covered numerous U.S. Opens. Is there any U.S. Open that really stands out for you over those years?
You know, every single one. I love the U.S. Open. It's our national championship, Bob. I think it lost its way as a major a little bit, you know, back, I don't know, more back sort of in the Chambers Bay era there where they were trying some experimenting with, you know, different types of rough and different types of venues and all that. And I'm really glad to see us going back more and more to the classic courses and the great U.S. Open venues. The one that I really have to look at, and it's probably my most memorable day ever in my career, was the Friday of the U.S. Open at Oakmont, which was Arnold Palmer's last U.S. Open round on that Friday. And it was going to be a complicated Friday anyway, because ESPN, which televised the second round, was going to World Cup Soccer Live right on the top of the hour at 3 o'clock. So they had scheduled Arnold Palmer to finish his round at about 2:30. And then I was going to do the interview with Arnold. Well, about 2 hours before that, O.J. Simpson got in the Bronco in L.A. and everything changed. And so it was just sort of mass chaos watching Arnold play the last nine holes and trying to figure out how we were possibly going to do this interview with Arnold. And in the end, it looked like it wasn't going to happen. Brent Musburger and Chris Berman were both announcing on ESPN, and they kind of signed off and said, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to get Arnold. And then Arnold basically came out of the scoring tent and came straight to me. So they didn't go to the soccer. They had already thrown it to the World Cup, and they said, wait, Arnold Palmer's going to talk to Mark. And they came down to me, and I asked him a first question, and he couldn't talk. Basically, the words would not come out of his mouth. And so for what seemed like an eternity, as I watched it now on ESPN's 30 for 30, it's probably only about 30 seconds that he didn't say anything, but it seemed like 10 minutes. And I have everybody yelling at me in my ear, producers and bosses saying, get him to say something. You know, I wasn't going to do anything. And without saying anything, you know, that was still the best interview I've ever conducted because he didn't need to say anything. And finally, he was able to get a few words out. And after he left, I took off my headset and went over and sat down under a tree and just bawled my eyes out. I knew there would never be another moment like that for me, and there hasn't been.
And you know, it's amazing, Mark. I was standing right in the area waiting to get Arnold Palmer on radio and watching you do your TV thing. I started to cry. So when Arnie came to me, he was crying. I'm crying. And I'm saying, how the heck can I do an interview? All I said was, thank you, Mr. Palmer, for everything that you have done. And that was it for me. I didn't have any more words. So I know exactly how you felt. That was one of the most remarkable scenes in golf with Arnie walking up the 18th hole on a Friday afternoon at Oakmont, just getting a standing ovation from the minute he got to the tee to the minute he left the green.
Yeah, it really was. It was quite something. And it proved to be such a difference in that week of what happened on Friday afternoon, you know, to Monday. You know, I'll never forget that playoff on Monday at Oakmont. It was 100 degrees, and it was, you know, it just, you know, strange stuff. Colin Montgomery in it, complaining about everything, and Ernie Els. I remember the second hole they played on that Monday. They made a bogey, a double, and a triple. Took about an hour to play it, and the whole thing became really, really awkward. It became an awkward U.S. Open. And I just kind of wish in some ways now that it had ended on Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying 100%. But still, one of the all-time special moments in golf, and you were right in the center of it, and only part of the reason I appreciate your work so much.
Well, I thank you. You know, a couple things have really changed for me, Bob. My little cancer scare about 7 years ago changed my entire life, obviously, but gave me a whole new perspective on things, and I think has caused me to be more thoughtful, more respectful, more appreciative, and hopefully a better communicator. And the decision by Golf Channel to kind of start using me in the studio position a lot with Brandel Chambly, you know, has really changed kind of my sort of being as an announcer. And all I have to do, if you look back at St. Andrews, for example, last year, I worked live from the Open Championship on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So for 3 days, I basically analyzed the entire tournament, championship, you know, the field, everything else. And then I went on to live golf. So if you think about what my role was for 4 days, on Thursday, I was on the course with Rory McIlroy, which was just amazing. He led, played a phenomenal round. On Friday, my assignment was Tiger Woods, who was probably walking his last trip around St. Andrews in major championship golf. That was a day I'll never forget. Saturday, I had Dustin Johnson and Scottie Scheffler, two of the best players in the world at the time. And then on Sunday, I had Cameron Smith, who won the Open. I will tell you this, I was way more prepared for each one of those individual days and those assignments because I had been, you know, on live from the Open Championship the first 3 days of the week. So I'm liking kind of doing that. And it gives me a much better chance of getting totally prepared than just sort of showing up and going out on the course on Thursday.
Sounds like it's kind of a springboard almost to the 4 days of the championship, right?
Well, it is. And again, I'm going to have a couple of different roles. It looks like I'm going to do some featured groups. I don't know. These are long days in California. We know that. But I think in some ways, Kelly, you know, all of this that's been happening around the game, whether it's LIV or golf ball rollbacks or anything else, has probably extended my career because, you know, that's kind of me now. And I got to tell you, I didn't know how long this career would go. And you take a look at kind of what's happened with some of my compadres like Roger Maltby and Gary Koch, you know, and even Johnny retiring. Yeah. You know, I kind of go back before all those guys. So I just wondered if there wasn't going to be a phone call one day. And the phone call I got was, let's sign up for a new deal. And I said, how fast can I sign? Where can I sign?
Well, listen to my trifecta with Mark Ralphing. And you just brought it to the forefront, Mark. I happened to be in the Houston airport when Mark was coming to Houston to go to MD Anderson for his cancer. You were courageous. You knew you had quite a battle. You went and you fought it and you survived. Then I'm fortunate enough to be with Mark Ralphing when Arnold Palmer finishes his U.S. Open career. And then we shared time in St. Andrews when Jack Nicklaus became a citizen of St. Andrews, joining only Bobby Jones as the only other citizen. And that's a trifecta. If I didn't do or ever do anything else, those three things are more than enough to make me feel my career was a success.
You know, Bob, I think you're trying to make me cry, just like we talked about Arnold. You know, when I listen to that and think about that, what the game has given me, I will never be able to repay. It's just been remarkable. I wake up every day and pinch myself and go, has this actually happened to me? Just the fact that I get to come on with Kelly Elvin and Bob Bubka and talk about the U.S. Open is just amazing. You know, like, why me? Why did this happen to me?
Well, we're the lucky ones.
Hey, Mark, as soon as they crown a U.S. Open champion, you and the folks at NBC Sports and begin to look ahead to the Open Championship at Royal Liverpool. Thoughts on that venue and what folks might expect to see once you head overseas?
Well, you know, the Open Championship is going to be so different from what we saw at St. Andrews. I don't know. You know, St. Andrews was such a question mark in my mind. I really felt like there was a danger that at the 150th Open, the length that the players were hitting the ball might render St. Andrews defenseless. But it did not at all. When you think about the winning score right at 20 under par and the way some of those holes played, the hole locations were tough. That was the defense of the grand old lady. But I think you're going to see the same thing at Liverpool. Everybody believes that it's a course that you can overpower, and there will be some guys that will go there and try to overpower it. But obviously Tiger Woods did it a different way and won at Liverpool playing a different kind of golf. I think the Open Championship at Liverpool would be a much more wide open tournament in terms of who could win and who couldn't win. I think it'll be way more wide open than the U.S. Open next week. I don't think there are more than 15, maybe 20 players max that I feel could win that U.S. Open next week. But I would put that number closer to 50 at a place like Liverpool.
And then in September, and who knows who's going to be playing for which side with everything that's been going on, but the Ryder Cup will be played outside of Italy, outside of Rome, rather, for the first time, Marco Simone Golf Club. Mark, just in terms of the growth of the Ryder Cup, it's really, when it's bid for overseas, I mean, 4 years ago it was outside of Paris, now it's outside of Rome. It's kind of like almost the World Cup. It's at that level, and I would imagine even with the U.S. dominating 2 years ago, they haven't won in 30 years on European soil. They're going to be in for a heck of a fight.
Well, they are going to be in for a heck of a fight, Kelly. You know, I don't know much about that golf course, but I've come to know that when they play the Ryder Cup in Europe now, we're going to see narrow fairways, high rough, a difficult test. You know, they're going to set it up to try to favor the European players. And I do not believe any of these LIV guys will be playing in the Ryder Cup for Europe. I think there's a better chance you would see some Americans playing on the American Ryder Cup team than you would see for the European Cup, because those players have resigned their membership over in Europe. And if they wanted reinstatement, they had to reapply for May on May 1st of this year in order to play in this Ryder Cup. Nobody did that. So having said that, I still believe, Kelly, that Europe is going to be the favorite there. And I'm sure people are going to listen to this and say, wait a minute, are you kidding me? Look what happened at Whistling Straits. And the U.S. side is just absolutely stacked. There's no way Europe can beat them. Strange things can happen in Ryder Cups, especially in short matches, when you've got 18-hole matches. And the top of that European lineup with Rahm and Hovland and McIlroy and Hatton and Fitzpatrick. Yeah. Look, the end of it, the end of the roster, you know, positions 9, 10, 11, 12 maybe aren't going to be that strong, or players that we haven't heard that much of, but they can still win the Ryder Cup. All they need is tremendous production from those top guys. I think Europe will be the favorite going into that Ryder Cup.
Hey, Mark, we have to say goodbye. We appreciate your time. But since you're one of the good guys and have been for quite some time, I'd like to get you to comment on what Victor Hovland did this past week. He wins Memorial, and then on Monday, he shows up caddying for his college roommate. If that doesn't say what's good about golf, I don't think there's anything that could say it any better.
Yeah, I can't think of an ambassador for the game right now, particularly as we're trying to grow to a younger audience. There's no better ambassador than Victor Hovland. I love that guy. You know, he's kind of a self-taught player. He's a YouTube, you know, aficionado, and he's on it all the time, working on a swing and doing this and that. But it says so much about the game that, you know, that we still have even a young, cool player like Hovland in his 20s, willing to go out and caddy the day after he just won one of the biggest championships in golf. That really says a lot. I that just warmed my heart.
Well, you warmed our hearts, and I'm going to say goodbye, but I'll let Kelly get the final word in.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Mark Rolfing, thank you. Thank you again. We're really excited, looking forward to seeing you and hearing from you next week. And I think, Mark, also the fact that it's the first time it's ever been played at LA Country Club is a fun dynamic to this 123rd U.S. Open.
All right. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. I think it's going to be a great U.S. Open. I cannot wait. And let's make a deal. Let's do this again before the Ryder Cup. How about that?
The all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X are designed to outperform. Created in Titleist R&D laboratories, manufactured in Titleist golf ball plants, and then validated by the best players in the world. These golf balls are longer and more consistent with unrivaled control. Outperform with the new Titleist Pro V1 and Pro V1X.
Oh, Bob, what a pleasure. You and Mark have such a great friendship. And boy, is he a thorough professional, huh?
He really is. And as nice as he sounds on the air, trust me, in person, he's even nicer. And his lovely wife, Debbie, they are a very powerful force in the world of golf.
They really are. And we really appreciate Mark Rolfing's time. And again, as we continue our lead up to the 123rd U.S. Open next Tuesday, we'll be visiting with Mike Wan, the CEO of the United States Golf Association. Can't wait to hear what Mike has to say. For my good friend Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Musings on Golf.